Ajuda.
Mike, thank you very much for that kind introduction, rather better than the one I had a few days ago, where the chairman said, do you want to speak now, or shall we let them enjoy themselves a bit longer? Now, I feel I've come here slightly under false pretenses, because when I was asked to speak, I very rashly said, yes, I'll talk about Guy Burgess and all his connections with Graham Greene. Then I went and did a bit of research, and I found this quote from Graham Greene. I only met Burgess twice. Once over coffee with David Footman. Footman was another MI6 officer during the war. And once when he forced himself on me on my visit to Moscow as a guest of British Airways in 1961. I don't know why he particularly wished to see me, as I didn't like him. I was leaving early the next morning, and I had begun a serious attack of pneumonia. However, curiosity won, and I asked him for a drink. He drove away, my very nice translator, saying that he wished to be alone with me. But the only thing that he asked of me was to thank Harold Nicholson for a letter, and on my return to give Baroness Budberg a bottle of gin. So what I'm going to do in the next, I think you've given me 3 hours, haven't you, this morning, is to talk about Guy Burgess, but also to talk about some of the other figures, in a sense, that cross over into his life, but also into Graham Greene's, people like Peter Smollett, Peter Smolka, Baroness Budberg, Harold Nicholson. I think also to look at the spying world, both drawn very much to the spying world, and of course that relationship that Graham Greene had with Kim Philby, probably Burgess's closest friend. So though the structure of the talk, I think, will be mainly about Guy Burgess, and he's certainly, I think, worth learning about, I will try and integrate as much as I can in terms of Graham Greene. Now, I've written several biographies. My previous biography was the life of John Buchan, the author of the 39 Steps and Governor General of Canada. It was called The Presbyterian Cavalier. And people said to me, I can understand why you wrote about a very dour Scotsman. I can see you could identify with him. But what have you got in common with Guy Burgess? He was a communist. He was gay. He was charming. He was intelligent. And I always point them to this picture. And I said, well, at least we had the same hairstyle. Now, this picture has a little history. I wouldn't recommend this to any of my authors, but I took 30 years to write this book. I mean, I did other things in between. So I started in 1985, just after I'd helped write a book on Anthony Blunt. And I wrote it very quickly in 2015, when I discovered there was a rival biography on its way. But in the 1980s, I went and interviewed Stephen Runciman, who'd been Burgess's tutor at Cambridge. And Runciman, first of all, he pretended that he hadn't actually agreed to meet me, so I'd driven all the way up to Scotland. Anyway, I got in, and he said, yes, I met him a few times, and that was it. I remember he had very dirty fingernails. Well, by chance, through the day job a few years ago, I was actually back in that house in Scotland, and then mentioned I was doing the book on Burgess to his niece. And she said, you must come upstairs and look at the photo albums. They were lovers for 3 years. So there are certain advantages in taking your time on books. And this is a picture from the Runciman collection taken on the Island of Egg when Burgess was staying there in 1932. So let's start our story. I've got 93 slides to get through in my 3 hours. So we'll start quickly here. This is April. This is the house where he was born in Devonport in southwest of England. His father was a naval officer, but often away from home. And I think this is one of the characteristics of a lot of the Cambridge spies, the absent father. And you may see certain parallels when I talk about Burgess's life in terms of Graham Greene's own life, not just the spying life, but his personal life. Philby's father was abroad, Maclean and Blunt's fathers died when they were very young. And I think this absent father is a very important key in the whole story. And what I'll try and do in the course of the talk, and what I tried to do in the biography, was to, in a sense, chart the story of how someone who was very much at the heart of the establishment could eventually seek to betray it. What was it? What were the trigger points through that life that set him off on this path to treachery? This is the absent father, Malcolm Burgess. Not, I have to say, a very successful naval officer. He rose to become a commander. His son used to boast to his school friends that his father had been hunting U-boats during the First World War in the North Sea. I'm afraid the truth was rather different. He was servicing craft in Tyneside. But it's again an element of the fantasy nature of Burgess, of the fantasist in Burgess from a very early stage. He was very close to his mother, Eve, who came from a very prosperous background. Her father had run a bank, which was sold to Lloyd's Bank, and indeed throughout Burgess's life and her life, they lived off trust funds. Very almost Oedipal relationship. I mean, they're almost like love letters between them. One of my great regrets when I was researching the book was to discover that all her his letters to her had been thrown into her grave when she died, until MI5 very conveniently, I noticed, intercepted them all, and they were all sitting in the National Archives. But they're very, very bizarre letters. He was brought up after a few years at this house called West Lodge in West Meon, which is on the Portsmouth Road. Again, you can see a very nice Georgian house. It had paddocks and stables, large grounds. And here, he and his younger brother, Nigel, were brought up by governesses. And it was here that his father retired in the early 1920s. There had been, after the First World War, cuts in the Navy. He realized he wasn't really going to get anywhere. There were so many people ahead of him in terms of preferment, and so he took early retirement. And this is actually, there was a portrait, a painting, based on this picture in the front hall in West Lodge. And Burgess always called his father the commander. So at the age of 10, he was sent off to a prep school very close to where we are now, and there's a very strong link with Burgess with Hertfordshire. This is Locust Park, then the most well-known and expensive prep school in Britain. It had just educated Lord Mountbatten, the subject of my next book. Other contemporaries were people like James Lees-Milne, Tom Mitford, the brother of the Mitford sisters, Martin Charteris, who was eventually become private secretary to the Queen. So again, one of the interesting parts of the story is that many of the people that Burgess would work with later in his life or deal with him were people he had known since a very early age. What I like about Locust Park is that they divided the houses into colours. Can you get a guess which colour house Burgess was in? Yeah, he was a red, even at the age of 10. Here he is, this very angelic boy in the first 11 football team. We often think of him as a bit of a slob who just drank and didn't really do anything, any exercise. In fact, he was an extremely good sportsman, a very good swimmer and runner. He'd been given a piece of advice at school that exercise was bad for your health. So on those grounds, he did give it up when he left school. But throughout his career at school, he was actually a very conscientious, studious, conventional pupil. He was so bright at Locust Park that though he was destined to go to Dartmouth and follow his father's footsteps at the age of 13 and a half, the school decided that they taught him everything that they could. And so at the beginning of 1924, he was sent for a few terms to Eton. And this is his house at Eton. And it was there just before the beginning of the autumn term in about this time, 1924, that a family tragedy took place. According to Burgess, then only 13, he was woken by anguish cries from his parents' bedroom. He ran next door to find that his father had died in the course of making love to his mother. And the young boy had to take the screaming and trapped woman, separate them, the two bodies. And this, he said, was to create a very powerful effect on him, as you can imagine, not just in terms of his sexuality, but also his relationship with his mother. Now, in most, I think, conventional households, if you've just gone through some traumatic event like that, the father was only in his 40s, you would probably keep them at the same school where they're happy. But, of course, this was a different time. And only a few weeks later, beginning of 1925, Burgess begins at Dartmouth. Very, very different place. As you can see, he's wearing naval uniform. He's subject to military discipline. There's a very harsh, flogging. He actually gets into BDSM later in his life. You can perhaps wonder if it begins here at Dartmouth. They have to run everywhere. And, of course, instead of learning Latin and Greek and history, which was his great love, he is learning seamanship and engineering. This is his term picture. And I talked to a lot of his contemporaries because, of course, in 1985, they were only in their early 70s. And they all said to me, he was the one that we thought would all succeed, perhaps not in the way that it turned out. But of all the people there, they thought he would be the man who would get chief flag rank and become an admiral. Six of those people did achieve flag rank. Half of them died in the Second World War. So if Burgess had stayed at Dartmouth, we might have had a very, very different picture. But he didn't. Suddenly, in the summer of 1927, he mysteriously is withdrawn from the school. The rumours, rather like the Winslow boy, that he's been caught stealing. There's talk of his homosexual activities. But I think the truth, I'm afraid, is not as exciting as that. It's just his eyesight wasn't good enough to become a naval officer. And that was certainly marked when he did his eyesight test during the Second World War. And I think the fact that he was taken back by Eton suggests that there really was no scandal. So Burgess, in 1927, goes back to Eton. This is his house. His his housemaster is a man called Frank Dobbs, the man with the moustache beside the cups. And they became actually very close. They used to go on holiday together. And Frank Dobbs really couldn't believe it, that his star pupil had fled to Russia in 1951. There's long correspondence with that in Eden saying, you know, this can't be true. Burgess continues being this very conventional schoolboy. It might surprise you that he's a corporal in the OTC. This is them on exercise in Windsor Great Park. The other corporal was the cricket commentator, Brian Johnson. So it's an interesting combination. He is, again, in the football team. He's very active as an artist. He wins a lot of prizes for that. He even wins prizes for things like religion. He's becoming slightly more political. He's involved with political society and the debating society through a mentor of his called Robert Burley, known as Red Robert, who would later become headmaster, who was pinkish, I would say, rather than red. So we can then begin to see Burgess being drawn to the left and having greater sympathy with the underdog. The only real change in his life at this time is his mother gets remarried, and she gets married to this man, a colonel in the Berkshire Regiment called Jack Bassett. Now, Jack Bassett was a rather fascinating character. He'd been an intelligence officer, and during the First World War had been T. Lawrence's right-hand man during the Arab Revolt. You can see he's a bit of a stickler. He was known as the colonel. The father was a commander. The stepfather was the colonel. And the two things that really annoyed the colonel, one was passing the port round the wrong way, and the other was standing up and giving toast to Uncle Joe Stalin, both of which, of course, his stepson did with immediate relish at every opportunity. And again, one of the amazing things in this dynamic, two things are amazing. One is that Burgess learnt about the marriage, not from his mother, but from his housemaster. And the other is that his mother encouraged this tension and this baiting of the stepfather. She actually rather enjoyed the two of them having these fights. Burgess goes into the history sixth. He wins the Rosebery History Prize. He becomes a house prefect, so he's not all bad. But the thing that he really wants is to be a member of POP. POP is a group of self-elected prefects at Eton who have special privileges. They wear waistcoats. They can beat. Must have been an attraction to him. And he tries six times in a couple of terms to get elected. And there's no way he's ever going to be elected. It tends to be for the children of aristocrats and the captain of cricket rather than for the children of naval officers and people who are good at history. So again, they have this sense, not just of self-entitlement, but also how he, in a sense, deceives himself. His great friend, Michael Berry, later the owner of the Telegraph, puts him up. He doesn't get it. And this is the beginning of his sense of resentment against the establishment, the sense that he hasn't been given his just deserts. There's a quote that Philby uses, to betray, you have to belong, I never belonged. And we begin to get this sense now of Burgess not feeling that he belongs. And those of you who've seen Julian Mitchell's play Another Country will recognize the character of Guy Bennett there as being Guy Burgess. Now, in spite of that, he's one of the star leavers. This is him in Monarch, which is the boat that goes down the Thames for the star leavers at Eton, dressed in his knee breeches. And from Eton, he wins a major open history scholarship to Trinity College, Cambridge. One of his fellow scholars on High Table is Enoch Powell. I always wonder what, again, they talked about. Now, for those of you who don't know Trinity, it's the largest of the Cambridge colleges, it's the richest, and it likes to think it's the grandest. They always claim that God was a Trinity man. And it's here in the Great Quad that he lives in his first year. He carries on his academic career. He joins the fashionable clubs, the Pitt Club, which was filled with auditonians. He gets involved with drama. And this is where he meets Michael Redgrave and people like Davy Rylands and Arthur Marshall. He not only acts and plays, but he also does the set design. He takes up punting, this is his boyfriend at the time, a fellow communist who, like a lot of the communists at that time, later became a Conservative MP. Now, I should perhaps just say at this moment, since we only have 3 hours, that if there's a man in the picture here who, with Burgess, he's one of his lovers, okay, it'll just save us time. I think one of the most one of the shocking things I found reading the book is that Burgess was extremely promiscuous. He claimed that he could seduce anyone, and there are plenty of examples of him doing exactly that. He even seduced a petrol attendant in the period it took to buy some petrol at one point. He was, I think, one of the most flamboyant, well-known characters in Cambridge at this time. He had plenty of money, he had a sports car, he was good-looking, he was highly intelligent, the stories about him are legion. Supposedly he tried to pick up the captain of the boat club on his first night in Cambridge. He really had no shame. And he was one of the people that a local photographic agency called Ramsay & Muspratt took photos of in this first year. And these are some of the pictures taken of him in this first year. So you can see a pretty impressive, good-looking boy. He gets a first at the end of his part ones, one of only 13 in history across the university, so it gives you a sense of his brain power. He comes very close to Runciman. This is him staying at one of the Runciman properties. I think this sums him up beautifully, doesn't he? The workers are doing the work, and he's having a snooze, and this sort of this summed him up perfectly. And these are some pictures of him on the Island of Egg with his tutor, and this is pictures taken at the end of June 1932. He's just got a first, and he's on this picnic with a boyfriend at the time called Jack Hunter. Now, Jack Hunter claimed to be the illegitimate son of Douglas Fairbanks, the author. Now, my first instinct was to say, here's another fantasist, when I'm afraid he was the illegitimate son of Douglas Fairbanks, later a scriptwriter in Hollywood. And these are pictures taken from a scrapbook that I got from one of the other people who was on the picnic. And this is where the story changes. I don't know if you recognize anyone here. This is probably the most well-known secret society in the world, the Apostles. You might recognize the man at the bottom left. Anthony Blunt, absolutely. Anthony Blunt had been one of Burgess's boyfriends at Cambridge. Donald MacLean was another. Blunt's boyfriend at that time was the man standing diagonally over there. You get 10 points if you guess who he is. Member of the Bloomsbury group, Julian Bell, killed in the Spanish Civil War. So that's Blunt's boyfriend at the time. Now, the Apostles is very important in this whole story because for two reasons. One is that most of them were gay at a time when homosexuality was illegal. And they had a very strong sense, therefore, of being outside society, a sense that if society wasn't prepared to recognize them, indeed was prepared to criminalize them for their sexuality, then they didn't feel they had an allegiance to that particular society. They were also the brightest and the best in the university. A lot of them were philosophers. They didn't feel, one of the fellow members was Ian Forster, and you may remember Forster's comment, "I hope I would have the guts to betray my country before my friend." And that was very much the attitude of the Apostles. They believed in higher truths. And they became a target for the Russian intelligence services. The Russians initially had recruited other journalists and various people they came across. But at the beginning of the 1930s, they decided that they would target universities and the brightest students in these universities and recruit them as long-term penetration agents, send them into the civil service, the Foreign Office, the BBC, the Times. They did this right across Europe, but it was particularly effective in Britain, I think because of the close nature of the all-boy network here. And the Apostles were targeted. So in fact, most of the people in that picture were recruited by the Russians. And this is again in one of the, I think, the myths about the Cambridge Five, that there were only five of them. There were more like 50. It's a much, much bigger operation. None of them, of course, ever were sent to prison. They were all given immunity or allowed to escape. Hugh Sykes Davis, the man nearest to me, was still teaching at Cambridge when I was there in the early 80s. Andrew Cohen, the man next to him, became an ambassador in Africa, and one could carry on. So this became very important, as I say, a recruitment ground for the Russians. Cambridge had become extremely politicized by this period. This, we're now reached 1933. There was a sense among the student body that the only bulwark against communism, against fascism, was communism on the Popular Front. And this was a seminal moment in Cambridge history. This is the Armistice Day, March, November 1933. You can see Donald MacLean is under the R of War. And this was then, since when they stood up and said, we want to be counted. We are, and this was a joint group of the communists and actually the Christian Union in Cambridge. Now, Burgess was on this walk, but being Burgess, he didn't walk. He went by car with Julian Bell. And of course, when the hunger marchers came to Cambridge shortly after this, and as a mark of solidarity, the students walked with them down to London, Burgess went by train, joined them in Hyde Park for the final bit. So you're getting a sense of what he was like. His close friend at Cambridge was Kim Philby. They both read history at Trinity. Philby was in the year above, and Philby had gone off to Vienna to get involved with the communist underground there, and that's where he met a woman called Litzy Friedman, who was a Soviet agent. And Philby was the first of the Cambridge recruits. He was sent back to Cambridge with a list of seven of his pals to recruit them for the Russian Secret Service. At the top of the list was Donald MacLean. At the bottom of the list was Guy Burgess. We do not know who numbers 2 to 6 were, whether they were approached and turned down the offer, or whether they accepted and have never been caught. What we do know is that Philby, MacLean was recruited at the end of 1934, probably November, December, and Burgess was recruited about January 1935. And the Russians, being very efficient, numbered their recruits. We know that there's actually quite a big numerical gap in the lists between Donald MacLean and Guy Burgess. We also know from Venona decrypts, this is Russian code traffic that was broken after the war, the names of some of the agents, people like poet, chauffeur, professor. We just don't know who they are. So this was, as I say, a much bigger operation than people realize. So this is Burgess at the time of his recruitment. And Burgess had been caught at a very opportune moment, because though the two things that have been most important in his life up to this point were his political activities — he was very involved with the communists at Cambridge — but also his academic career. He was expected to get a first in his part twos, but he didn't. He had a nervous breakdown in the exam and was carried out and was given what we call, describe as an agritat. In spite of that, he was allowed to stay on at Trinity. He taught some undergraduates. In fact, he coached the man who would later be the man in charge of the investigation into him in Foreign Office security. He actually got him into the Foreign Office. He also started work on a PhD, but he quickly abandoned it just when he discovered that someone else was doing exactly the same subject, and he became extremely depressed. He felt he'd lost all purpose, all validation. And this is when the Russians very cleverly stepped in and gave him that sense of purpose. The rebel without a cause suddenly found one. It was done in a very sophisticated way. I think we forget, actually, we always think of the KGB as thugs. It was done in a very sophisticated way, and I'll show you two of the recruiters that were used. This is Donald MacLean, who was the second of the recruits after Philby, just passed the Foreign Office with the first in modern languages. And this is the third of the recruits, Anthony Blunt. Burgess became the recruiter not just in Cambridge, but also in Oxford. And so he's a very important figure in the network. This is Blunt on a trip to Russia. And the fifth member is this man called John Cancross. Very important member, because he went to work at Bletchley. He had passed first into the Foreign Office. You can see it's a very high-powered team of people. Burgess also recruits this man. This is the Oxford side of the ring. This is a man called Gurumbi Rees, who was a fellow at All Souls. And there are two theories about the Oxford ring. One is that they were so brilliant that none of them were ever caught, and the other is that it was so useless that nothing ever happened. So I'll leave you to make up your own mind which you want to believe. So Gurumbi Rees is one of the few that was recruited. And this is the American side, which we don't often think about. Michael Strait, about to become president of the Union, gives it up, goes back to the States, joins the State Department, very close friends with Roosevelt and other people like that. And he is the man who in 1963 goes to the authorities and shops Blunt. and leads to Blunt being questioned and given immunity. So an important figure in the story. And this is the first of the recruiters, a man called Arnold Deutsch, very sophisticated Central European, had a PhD in physics, but was also a sexicologist, spoke half a dozen languages. He was doing research as what we call an illegal, under deep cover, here in London at London University. And he was the man who brought Burgess in. And indeed, one of the attractions for the Russians was the fact that Burgess was gay, that he had this clandestine network of friends that he had to separate his life, divide his life, because, of course, homosexuality was illegal. And he was helped by this man called Theodor Mali, who was a Hungarian cavalry officer, who then later became a priest, and then eventually joined the Comintern and became one of their chief recruiters in Europe. They operated out of Paris. And this is the third important handler. I mean, many of the handlers, Burgess and MacLean had several handlers, many of whom died in the purges. There's a man called Yuri Modin, who only died a few years ago. I interviewed him for my book. As you can see, a very sort of westernized figure. This is a picture of him on Box Hill. So Burgess comes down from Cambridge. He's been tasked by the Russians to find out what's going on in terms of activities on the far right. There's a great worry in Russia about what Germany's up to. He goes to work for this MP for Chelmsford, a man called Jack McNamara, who also happens to be his lover and a man who is a secretary of the Anglo-German Club. He also is taken under the wing of this man. I don't know if any of you recognize him. Harold Nicholson, absolutely. Husband of Vita Sackville-West. His sons have been at Eton with Burgess. I mean, he was old enough to be his father. He became not only a very important mentor and protector to Burgess through his life, but also one of his long-term lovers. And it was Nicholson who helped Burgess get into the BBC. He'd failed to get into the Times. Graham Greene, as you know, had got in. Burgess had failed. But he managed to get into the BBC, partly through Nicholson and partly through a recommendation from G.M. Trevelyan, the professor of history at Cambridge. So he had some pretty powerful sponsors. BBC was an important target, not only because he could operate there as an agent of influence, but also because of the contacts that he could make. This is a picture of him, his BBC picture at the time. This has a bit of a history in that there's a long anguished correspondence in BBC archives saying, can you send us a headshot? We're tired of getting pictures of you on the sands at Margate. So this is eventually the picture the BBC got. There was always a running war with the BBC. He always insisted on travelling first class and taking taxis. And when the head of expenses would say, but it was only about 300 yards, he says, oh, yes, but I'm so tired. Anyway, this is a man, very charming man, as you can see, called Edward Pfeiffer. Now, Edward Pfeiffer has many claims to fame. He was the head of the French scouting movement. He was an extremely well-known sadomasochist who enjoyed playing ping-pong with naked boys as the net. He was also the secretary to Edward Daladier, the French Minister for War and later Prime Minister. And it was through Pfeiffer that Burgess was recruited into intelligence, through this friend of Graham Greene's called David Footman. David Footman was an MI6 officer who also wrote books. And Burgess had learnt about him through Donald MacLean, invited him to come and give a broadcast, and Footman, realising that Burgess had this wonderful network, this underground network in Paris and these links to the French, and they were, of course, very suspicious of the French, as we should always be, he was recruited to find out what the French cabinet were up to. And Burgess also went to work for... That's right. These two men. Do you recognise either of them? Anthony Eden. Everyone says Anthony Eden. It's Neville Chamberlain. They all look the same. Tweed suits and a moustache. But it's Anthony Eden. Anthony Eden also recruited Burgess through the man on the right to work, in a sense, as a courier for him, the secret network. And the man on the right is a man called Joseph Ball. Joseph Ball worked for Conservative Central Office as the dirty tricks man. He's an ex-MI5 officer. And he was the man behind the Zinoviev letter, if you remember that, the leaked letter that led to Labour losing the election. So Burgess is the first of the Cambridge Five to be recruited to go into British intelligence and proves to be very, very effective. He carries on at the BBC, but at the beginning of 1939, he's seconded to a secret unit called the Joint Broadcasting Committee. And here he works alongside people like Elspeth Huxley, the writer, and also Maura Budberg, who some of you may recognize as a friend of Graham Greene. She had been the lover of people like H.G. Wells and Gorky. She was worked very closely with Alexander Korda. She's an extraordinary character. There's a very good book on her that's just come out. And Burgess worked in the Joint Broadcasting Committee, which is part of MI6, beaming propaganda into Nazi Germany from stations in Liechtenstein and from Switzerland. He was then moved across. He was called the ideas man. He had this idea for what he called Guy Fawkes College, which would be a training unit to send agents to do both propaganda and sabotage. And this is Guy Fawkes College, Brickenbury, again very close to you here. And he goes to teach there in the summer of 1940. Of course, war has broken out. And he manages to bring across one of his chums from Cambridge, Kim Philby. So Kim Philby and Burgess come to teach at Brickenbury. So he's the man who gets Philby into MI6. Now, as you all know, Philby rises almost to the top of MI6. He's a brilliant career. I'm afraid Burgess doesn't last very long in MI6. According to the paperwork I've seen, he was chucked out after a few weeks for mucking about with a corporal. He'd also been caught drink driving, so I mean, he was not doing very well. But he is nothing if not a survivor. And with a few weeks, he's working for this old friend from Cambridge, a man called Kemble Johnson, again, who lived just around the corner here, as a freelance agent for MI5 called Vauxhall. Kemble Johnson reports to another old friend from Cambridge, Anthony Blunt. Anthony Blunt has been part of the British Expeditionary Force. He comes back. They've been told to get into British intelligence. He applies to MI5, and on one day, he gets two letters from MI5. One saying, we know you were a communist at Cambridge, we don't want you. The other saying, can you join on Monday? So that's what he does. And so Burgess works for Blunt, running two agents, this man called Eric Kessler, known as Orange, a Swiss diplomat and journalist who reports on the neutrals, another of Burgess's lovers, he's a married man with a young family, another Russian spy. And this man called Andre Reveille, a well-known gallery owner after the Second World War, a great champion of Graham Sutherland, he reported on the exile movements in London and under the codename Toffee. And he, again, was another lover of Burgess and another Russian spy. And these are some of the cast list of in a sense, the MI5 people during the war. And this, of course, now begins to bring us into the ambit of Graham Greene. This is a man called Guy Liddell, part of the Alice in Wonderland family, world-class cellist, MC in the First World War, one of the first recruits into MI5, brilliant career ahead, heading to be top of MI5 until, unfortunately, he meets Guy Burgess. And his great misfortune is that his wife, Calypso Baring, beginning of the war, runs off with her half-brother, which is, I think, an occupational hazard. And so Liddell is a very lonely figure, and he spends a lot of time going out to music halls with Burgess, spilling the beans on what's going on in the office. And of course, when the whole bubble bursts in the spring of 1951, Liddell is an immediate suspect. He's sacked, and his career is curtailed. The other colleague of Burgess in 5, who also eventually gets to run both 5 and 6, is Dick White, who was, of course, become a great friend of Graham Greene, working in Ryder Street. And Victor Rothschild. Anyone here a friend or relation of Victor Rothschild? Any libel lawyers? Right. Victor Rothschild, I think, is one of the interesting figures in this story. Burgess had something on him. He'd been in the back of a car when Victor Rothschild, driving from Cambridge to London, had killed a man. Rothschild was brought up on charges of manslaughter through a clever lawyer. He married the lawyer's daughter. He was got off. But Burgess always had a hold over Rothschild. Rothschild lent Burgess's flat during the Second World War. He has, I have to say, his file has been retained. When files were released a few years ago, his file was retained. He has, I have to say, a very close association with this. Some suggestions his wife Tess was also an agent and that they're part of a couple. Anyway, if the files ever get released, I'd be very interested to see what they say about Victor Rothschild. This was another of Burgess's friends at the time, his lover, man called James Pope Hennessy, quite a well-known royal biographer. And he was part of a ménage à trois with this lady, still alive in her mid-90s. Do you recognize her? The school lesson will end in a few minutes, I assure you. She's married to one prime minister and the niece of another. called Clarissa Avon, Clarissa Eden. Now, when I interviewed her and said, I understand that you were engaged to Guy Burgess, she said, that's absolutely ridiculous. I hardly knew him. Now, Burgess did have a habit of getting engaged to women without telling them. But this was not one of those occasions, and I was very pleased to see, we actually ran a story on this in the Sunday Times, and when the papers came out, that actually these two were engaged. Burgess had been told to get very close to her. The Russians had this bizarre idea that as the niece of Winston Churchill, she would have access to all sorts of secrets. Anyway, he became very friendly with her, and they saw a lot of each other during the war. The other woman that he saw a lot of at this time was Rosamund Lehmann. She was the girlfriend of Granby Rees. He used to go and stay with Rosamund most weekends at her house just outside Oxford until he tried to seduce her gardener. And that was the end of a beautiful relationship, because she said it was a lot harder to get gardeners than to keep friends. Burgess carries on through the Second World War, working for MI5, but also working at the BBC. He runs, and of course this is where he comes into the contact with Graham Greene, working in Ryder Street. They're mixing. Burgess has also been up in St. Albans with them. So he's very much mixing with Graham Greene. So when Greene says, I only met him twice, I suspect that Greene met him more often than that, just had forgotten that. So Burgess is running a program called The Week in Westminster, which gives him extraordinary powers of patronage, because he brings broadcasters. He can basically find young MPs and journalists and put them on the air and build their career. And, of course, he takes advantage of this. And one of the people that he nurtures is this man standing looking into the far distance to the left of Ernest Bevin, called Hector McNeill. Hector McNeill, at the end of the Second World War, becomes a Labour MP and the Minister of State in the Foreign Office, number two to Ernest Bevin. He is the man in charge of the intelligence services. And, whether this is chance or not, he decides he doesn't want just a private secretary in the Foreign Office, he wants, in effect, a special advisor. And he asks Guy Burgess to take on that role, a speechwriter and advisor. So you can't imagine, the Russians can't believe their luck. Here we are at the beginning of the post-war reconstruction, the future of Germany and Poland being discussed, the four-power conferences, the creation of the UN and other large supernatural organizations, that the Russians have a spy right at the heart of the Foreign Office. Hector McNeill is a very lazy man. He likes going to nightclubs. Burgess, contrary to his reputation, is actually very hardworking and conscientious, and he volunteers. He says, I'm a single man. I'm very happy to work late. I'm very happy to work weekends. Indeed, I'm very happy to take documents and work on them at home. And that's exactly what he does. 4,000 documents of this period find their way, go off to a safe house, are photographed and brought in the next morning. There's absolutely no document security in the Foreign Office whatsoever. It's a completely different world. Burgess one morning comes down at the four-power conferences wearing lipstick, and someone looks askance at him and says, the ambassador, isn't that slightly unusual for a diplomat? And the diplomat says, we tolerate eccentricity in the Foreign Office. So you can imagine it was a very much little all-boys network, and they took care of their own. But at this point, therefore, the Russians knew the British negotiating position at the four-power conferences before the British negotiating team themselves knew it. There's some wonderful japes as Burgess tries to takes these documents out. He liked to meet in pubs. The Russians preferred to meet in public parks, and there's always a bit of a tussle about where they meet. But there are wonderful moments. He and Blunt at one moment are stopped by a policeman and asked what they have in their suitcase. When they show them it's filled with secret documents, he said, that's fine, I thought you were burglars. Another time he's in the pub and his suitcase breaks and the papers spread all over the floor. The policeman very kindly comes and helps put them back in. So there's a wonderful sort of black comedy about this story, which I think Graham Greene would have relished. Anyway, Burgess goes to work for Hector McNeill. He is his right-hand man, even right up to the Berlin airlift and the crisis there. This is a cartoon he drew at the time. But MacLean also seconds in the beginning of January 1948 to a top-secret, again, propaganda organization called the Information Research Department. And this is to counter propaganda coming out of Russia and to feed and to do news management, which is one of Burgess's great skills, a very topical subject now. Burgess betrays the operation which works with MI6 within weeks of it being set up. He then goes to work in the Far Eastern Department as the Chinese expert. This, of course, is the period of the Chinese Civil War and Chiang Kai-shek. This is the period, of course, when America refuses to recognize Red China. But Burgess is so effective and so persuasive that he manages to persuade the British as the Chinese expert to recognize Red China. So, again, a very important agent of influence. Indeed, he's so respected in the Foreign Office that every summer at the Foreign Office Summer School in Worcester College, Oxford, he gives a talk on the evils of communism. He's the go-to man to talk about the evils of communism. This is just a little extra slide. This is a house near Newbury where his mother was living during the war. He had a cottage there, huge house again, ornamental lake, butler, 17 acres of grounds. Now, Burgess is beginning to crack up at this point. They're all beginning to crack up. This is the period just immediately after the Second World War. There are Russian defectors who are coming across and saying there is a spy in the British Foreign Office who went to Eton. Now, that doesn't limit things because most people in the Foreign Office at that time had gone to Eton. There are also decrypts. They know that it's only a matter of time before those decrypts are broken, this Venona code traffic, and that they're going to be rumbled. They're all drinking very heavily. Burgess is taking drugs for his insomnia. He's getting his drugs from a friend of his who's, a sister of a great friend of his, a man called Peter Pollock, who lived just around the corner here, who specialized in horses, who's never quite got the dosage right. So he's in a pretty bad way. He is knocked down and gets concussion at a gay nightclub. He goes to Ireland to recuperate. He then has a traffic accident where he's brought up in court for drunken driving. There's some suggestion he actually killed someone himself in the car accident. He then goes to recuperate in Tangier and Gibraltar, where he gets drunk. Gets involved in currency dealing. He reveals drunkenly the names of the head of the MI5 and MI6 station, and even more importantly, he begins to steal the Arab boys of the local residents. So he's brought back to face a disciplinary panel. This is now 1949. His days even Hector McNeil can't really protect him much longer. He goes to his disciplinary panel, and by a vote of 5-4, he's given one last chance. And his one last chance is to go to America, where it's now the summer of 1950. He's going off to set up the Far Eastern Department there. And he goes to live in this house in Washington with an old friend who's now working there as the liaison officer with the CIA and the FBI and the head of station, Kim Philby. And Kim Philby and his family live in the main part of the house. In the attic at the top, Philby installs his MI6 secretary and we think his mistress, a woman called Esther Whitfield. And in the basement goes Guy Burgess with the train set. And there's a good reason for Burgess to be there. It's always, of course, bad tradecraft to put two spies in the same house. But Philby isn't able to travel very easily. The Russians are servicing their agents in Washington from New York. Burgess is allowed to travel much more freely as a second secretary, and so he becomes the point man for Philby in Washington, and that's why they're together. This is Esther Whitfield, I think one of the most fascinating characters in this story. No one had known anything about her until I did the book. She was a career MI6 secretary, but in effect officer. She had been working with Philby in Turkey, first of all. She then came and worked with him in Washington. Burgess and she became very friendly, and Burgess proposed marriage to her in the spring of 1951. We don't know what her answer was because a few days later he fled to Russia. But she remained very, very close to him. It was to Esther Whitfield that he sent his last will and testament. She was one of the four beneficiaries of his will, together with Philby Blunt and his boyfriend in Russia, a man called Tolia. So very important figure in his life. They corresponded after he went to Moscow. She was sacked by MI6, quite without any justification. She never again had another job. She never again had another relationship and died in the 1980s in Wiltshire. So a really sad story. And I think that's one of the things we have to think about in this, that it isn't just jolly japes. And there was a lot of collateral damage that was done. This is a spy that actually I discovered, a new spy, or one of the few spies this period not to have gone to Trinity College, Cambridge, called Wilfred Mann, who'd been in Imperial College. He was the MI6 officer at the embassy. He was caught by Jim Angleton, who was an SCI officer, and what we call turned and played back, basically played back against the Russians in return for American citizenship. So one new spy for you. Burgess is his even worse state in Washington than he is in Britain. No one really wants him. He's drunk most of the time. Eventually, he's given a post, perfect post for him, which is to pick up American public opinion, which requires him to go and sit in bars all day and chat to people. But one of his other jobs is to go and talk to groups outside the embassy, go to conferences. And he's asked to speak at a military conference in Charleston, South Carolina, on China in February 1951. He's always loved cars. This is an example of the Lincoln convertible that he had when he was there. And he decides that he will drive down to this conference in Carolina. Now, when he went to Washington, he was given one piece of advice. Don't get involved with the race question. Don't get involved with homosexuals. Don't get involved with communists. So he'd quipped, well, I better not get involved with Paul Robeson then. So what does he do? As he drives down to Virginia, he picks up a black homosexual communist hitchhiker who for good measure, has just come out of prison for rape. So the two scoundrels drive down. They're picked up for speeding three times in the same day in the same state. The first time, Burgess tries to proposition the burly patrolman. The second time, when the other patrolman says, look, you were doing 50 miles an hour and it was only a 30-mile limit, Burgess remonstrates with him. That's rubbish. I was doing at least 70, he said. The third time, he says, when he's caught, he says, I'm going to report you to the governor. Well, I'm afraid the patrolman gets there first. The governor reports Burgess to the ambassador, and Burgess is asked to go back to Britain and to report to his superiors for another disciplinary panel. Timing on this is very good. This is the spring of 1951, because those Venona decrypts have now been broken. This is the code traffic the Russians were using. And the Americans have identified a spy in the British Embassy in 1944 called Homer. And the one thing they know about Homer is that Homer's wife has just gone to New York to have a baby. There's only one person that did that, and that's Donald MacLean. The Americans are very excited by this revelation. And who, of course, is the first person they share this with? The CIA and FBI liaison officer, Kim Philby. So Kim Philby realizes that they need to exfiltrate Donald MacLean. He needs to be warned. Now, poor old Burgess and MacLean have always been grouped together, like Marks and Spencer and everyone else. And actually, they'd had very little contact since Cambridge. They'd had an affair at Cambridge. When MacLean left Cambridge, he went to work in Paris, and then he went to work in Cairo, where he had a nervous breakdown. He smashed up the room for an American secretary. He was then sent off for 6 months psychiatric treatment. Now, what do you think he would do after that with someone like that, who's clearly completely bonkers? Well, you'd make him head of the American department, of course. So that's what happened. So Burgess goes back to talk to the head of the American department. They meet at the Reform Club, and they put together their plan for exfiltration. One of the great mysteries of this is, why use Burgess? Because, of course, that is only going to draw attention to Burgess and through Burgess to Philby. But that is a whole new ball game of discussion. So Burgess is sent down to basically get MacLean out. And so on MacLean, this is on the 25th of May, 1951. It's MacLean's 38th birthday. His wife is about to go and give birth to their third child. They know that the British authorities on the following Monday are going to interview him. Burgess drives down to his house just outside Westrum in Kent and picks up MacLean. They drive to Southampton. They catch a cross-channel steamer. And that is the last anyone hears them for the next 5 years. This is Burgess's lover, who's left behind, a man called Jack Hewitt, also a lover of Anthony Blunt, also a lover of Christopher Isherwood. You know those charts about who slept with whom that you can do? I tried one of those, but it just got so complicated I gave up. This is just a little picture of his room that he had a flat in New Bond Street. This is just gives you an idea of the slight peculiarity of the decor. Burgess was very patriotic, actually, ironically. All his rooms were decorated red, white, and blue, apart from the bathroom, which was always pink. This is the notice that was sent out saying that Burgess and MacLean had fled. What I love is that, is, I can't probably read it, it's the last line saying slightly pigeon-toed. The problem with this notice, they fled on Friday the 25th of May. This notice went out on the 7th of June. So a little late, really, to pick them up. And this is where, I suppose, the next part of the story comes into play, the cover-up. The conventional story is that no one among the British authorities knew they'd fled until the following Monday when MacLean didn't turn up to work. Except, I discovered that they'd been under surveillance. There'd been a phone call to the MI5 headquarters on that Friday night. They were preparing for the interview on the Monday, saying that they'd fled. And Dick White was sent in hot dispute with them until they found that his passport was out of date and he couldn't follow them. So that's one bit of evidence from a man called Russell Lee, who's an MI5 agent. The other bit of evidence that's interesting is I talked to a woman called Jane Portal, now known as Lady Williams, better known as the mother of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. And in May 1951, she was working for Winston Churchill as his secretary at Chartwell. And she says, on the Saturday afternoon, she volunteered this to me, that she got a message from the duty officer in the Foreign Office saying your neighbour has flown. Chartwell and Westrum are very close to each other. So Churchill was told on the following afternoon. So the story of that they only knew on the following Monday is complete baloney. But that's the record, that's the version that's still being pumped out. Even so, Herbert Morrison, who was the Foreign Secretary, was not told until Tuesday. And the story didn't break until, as I say, the 7th of June, when the French police leaked the story to a journalist, and all hell broke out. So, here is the German border guard who's been sent to look for them 2 weeks after they reach Moscow. This is the water diviner brought in by the Daily Express, who said with some conviction they were south of Paris. There's a wonderful correspondence in the National Archives with people reporting sightings, you know, at Hemel Hempstead railway station, two men dressed as women and things like this. My favourite is the woman who says, I know exactly where they are, they're underneath my floorboards and they're beginning to smell, so can you come quickly? So, two consequences of the flight. One was the sense of the cover-up, the sense the establishment had come together not to tell the full story. And the other was the damage to Anglo-American intelligence cooperation. This is a Percy Sillitoe, the head of MI5, who sent off to the Americans to explain, you've just had one spy, a man called Klaus Fuchs, who's disappeared, who's betraying your secrets. I'm afraid there have been two more. Hope that's okay. So that was one of the great consequences, really, of the story. As I said, it all went very quiet until February 1956. Khrushchev is due to come on a visit to London. This is, of course, the moment where he makes his great speech denouncing Stalin. They want to clear the air about Burgess and MacLean, and so Burgess and MacLean are paraded in a hotel room at a press conference in February 1951. Ironically, the room is Room 101. I don't know what George Orwell would make of that. And it gradually emerges what had happened to them. They'd been probably had gone through Bern and Prague. They'd then, having had a quick debrief in Moscow, been sent to a close city called Kubashev on the Volga. They'd been kept there until after the death of Stalin and then brought to Moscow, where they'd been given jobs, ostensibly working for Russian publishing houses, but actually advising the Russian Foreign Ministry on British politics. And from this period, really, lots of people were able to come and see them. And one of the people who came to see Burgess, as he was later to go and visit Philby, was Graham Greene. Of course, he'd been fascinated by the whole Cambridge spy story, from the time that he met Philby. This is Tom Dryberg, who was one of these people that Burgess had worked with during the war as a journalist. And he came out and wrote the first biography. I have to say, not entirely accurate. Burgess was very careful not to incriminate himself, and when he was asked why he'd come to Moscow, he said he came as a tourist, which Dryberg just took down. There's an interesting twist here in that Dryberg was a British MI5 agent, and one of the reasons he was sent off to do this book was so that MI5 could get information from Burgess about what had actually happened in his life. Burgess, of course, was very careful and didn't incriminate himself. Dreiberg, and no good turn goes unpunished. Dreiberg, while he was in Moscow, had found Burgess a lover. He was an extremely expert cottager. He found this young lover called Tolia in the urinals at the, I think, Metropole or National Hotel. But in the course of finding Tolia, who was a KGB plant, he was himself recruited by the KGB as a KGB agent. So that gives you a little footnote to this story. So here is Burgess at his dacha outside Moscow with his dog called Joe. And this is the block of flats he lived in Moscow, opposite the Novodevichy Monastery. Now, when I first researched the book, I discovered he spent a lot of time in the monastery, and I thought that was because this lifelong agnostic had discovered religion. Well, I discovered that wasn't the case. He discovered a 6'7" Russian priest. This is him in April 1962. There's been a leak that Burgess is going to come back to Britain. The establishment are absolutely aghast. The last thing they want is him coming back. And so they ask Blunt, not realizing Blunt's real role in this thing, to tell his friend don't to come back. That suits Blunt very well too. They put out quite illegally an arrest warrant for him. They have absolutely no evidence. Burgess knows this, but actually Burgess doesn't turn up in April 1962. Now, for those who've seen An Ancient Abroad, the Alan Bennett play, that very much is a very accurate portrayal of Burgess in Moscow. He's extremely lonely, but he did have all his books and pictures and things sent out to him. He was very musical. Here he is playing the piano. His needs, as I said, the Russians would say, were met. So he was given a housekeeper, a small flat, a boyfriend who kept an eye on him. He was under strict curfew. He was followed everywhere. Really was given not much purpose. He used to hang around the Bolshoi. He would sidle up to people in their seats and say he had a gold tooth because he'd been punched in by someone when he tried to seduce him in Kubashev. You know, do you know who I am? The person would look at it blankly and he said, I'm the man who saved the West from the Third World War. He would get drunk at receptions at big hotels and urinate in the fireplace. He was a bit of a disaster. And the reason that he met Coral Brown, which, as you know, is the basis of the story, he didn't go out to meet Coral Brown. He went actually to see Michael Redgrave. Michael Redgrave and Coral Brown were both appearing in Hamlet, and Burgess went to see Redgrave after the show. Redgrave heard him coming and locked the door of his dressing room. And as a result, Burgess went in and was sick into Coral Brown's sink instead. And that was the beginning of the relationship. But it's very, very accurate. I talked to one foreign correspondent who'd gone to Salisbury Secondary School, who'd watched the Daily Record, and he was sent back to buy 50 old Etonian bow ties in German Street. And he said that when he went into the shop, the very supercilious shop assistant there looked at him rather suspiciously, and he said, are these for you, sir? And I said, oh, no, they're for a friend. And he said, that's what they all say, sir. So Burgess's old mum comes to see him. There he is. And Mary Fedden, who's quite a well-known artist, this picture on the Moscow River. He spends a lot of time sunning himself in the Black Sea resorts. But he's drinking very heavily. He's got diabetes. He's got heart problems that his father suffered from. He's smoking very heavily. And in August 1963, he dies at the age of 52. This is a picture of his funeral. The man in the middle there is his younger brother, Nigel. Nigel had followed his brother through Locust Park, Eton, Trinity College, Cambridge, indeed into MI5. After the war, he becomes an advertising man. And he is the man behind those PG tip ads with the chimps, if you remember those. That's his claim to fame. Nigel told me a good story. He said that when Burgess died, of course, his name, the news made headlines around the world. And when he went to Thomas Cook to buy his ticket, the woman looked at him. She thought, that name's familiar, Burgess. Will that be a single, sir, or a return? um, So this is Nigel, Natalia, the housekeeper, Melinda McLean, who's there, then Natalia, who's crying, and then Donald McLean. McLean's wife had come and joined her husband in the mid-1950s. Shortly after this, Philby had also come to Moscow, and Melinda McLean would leave Donald and go and have a relationship with Philby. Burgess left most of his clothes to Philby, who was the same size. He left him this wingback armchair, which is still in Rufina Philby's flat. He left him most of his library, most of which turned out to be library books, which had never been returned. He left a little bit of money to some of the other figures. His great dream had been to come back to Britain, to see his mother, to see his friends. And of course, he never achieved that in his lifetime. But Nigel brought back the ashes from the funeral, and under cover of darkness, in October 1963, with just his wife and the minister, they buried his brother in the family plot. He was reunited here, this grave nearest to me, with his father, and here, a few months later, his mother was also buried. So that ends the story of Guy Burgess. And I think the three things I think say to you. One is, I mean, the big question is, why did he do it? Was this a political thing or a private thing? And I think it was very much a private revolt. I mean, he was a Marxist historian, but I think Stephen Runciman talked about it, petit la bourgeoisie. He loved riding with the hares and the hounds. He loved the sense of getting back at the establishment, the sense of power. Graham Greene, I think, had was very astute about this. He talked about... in The Confidential Agent, you choose your side once and for all. Of course, it may be the wrong side. Only history can tell that. And I think that was very much the line that Burgess felt, that he, you had to break a few eggs to make the omelette, but in time, people would judge him. He came from Huguenot stock. He saw himself as someone who prevented World War. He's very anti-American. How did he get away with it? Well, it is extraordinary. I mean, he was never actually caught for cottaging, though, of course, many of his friends were. He came quite close in 1937 when, as his friend said, he met his Waterloo at Paddington. He had been caught passing notes between cubicles. He said that he was exchanging notes on Jane Austen, and the police believed him. You can see he had extraordinary charm. He did go and flee to France for a while, but he was never caught for any of that. He was never caught for spying. I mean, he was caught for being untidy and having garlic and pornography in his drawers in the Foreign Office. He used to joke that he used to keep it all in Ernest Bevin's secret safe, to which he had the key. I think it was, it's extraordinary that he got away with it. How much damage did he do? Again, it's very difficult to judge. The Americans did an audit and took the view that everything that had crossed his desk was compromised. But if you think that he had picked up gossip, really, from people, everyone broke, gave him stories. He used to lend his flat for assignations to his colleagues for both homosexual and heterosexual relationships and then blackmail them. So when he fled, they found all these love letters in a guitar case and thought, that's rather sweet, until they discovered he'd been keeping them for these blackmail purposes. But he'd been an agent of influence in the BBC and then in the Forest Department, and then I would say also in Moscow. He'd clearly been very important in this pre-war period when he was feeding material back to the Russians, which I would argue helped shape the Nazi-Soviet pact. He'd clearly been very powerful when he was working for Hector McNeill in the Foreign Office. Who were the sort of the people he was running across? Well, clearly Philby. I mean, you know about the close relationship with Philby and Green. Philby was Philby's son, eldest daughter, was one of Burgess's godchildren, who's still alive, Josephine. So they were very, very close. And I think Graham Greene must have met him far more often than twice. They both worked in the Ministry of Information at the same time, at the beginning of the war. They were both up in St. Albans. They must have met through Kim Philby, but I've not found any other records of that. They clearly knew this person, David Footman. They also had this friend in Maura Budberg. So they would have, again, I think, met through her. They had a lot of the same friends like John Cairncross and A.J. Eyre. So I think there's room for more research. I mean, maybe someone here will be able to go out and find some more about it. But anyway, thank you very much for listening to me. I know I haven't made my 3 hours, but I'm very happy to answer any questions.